Spy in the Sky. Interview. Ola Damago.
But you know, it's like I use what I call normal Farmer Brown logic. 1 + 1 = 2. If you are some laboratory expert or a professor and...
Spy in the Sky. Interview. Ola Damago.
But you know, it's like I use what I call normal Farmer Brown logic. 1 + 1 = 2. If you are some laboratory expert or a professor and or a 3D animation program super thing presented by NBC or whatever that says that 1 + 1 = 37, it's just not true. I mean, even if they can prove it, apparently it's not, you know. And then this is often a very good starting point, because if somebody's trying to push that down your throat, there's a reason why they try to cover this whole thing up. And then if you start backtracking that lie, it will lead to more lies, and it will slowly get you back to the real crime and the motive behind it. So it's through the lies that you can track these things. Now, many of these things are absolute no-brainers, you know, like the killing of Robert Kennedy. You got Sirhan Sirhan in front of him, okay? He's got a revolver with 8 bullets. He starts shooting. He's not closer than 1 meter, 1 meter 30, depending on who you talk to. As soon as he started firing, there were people so close to him that jumped him and threw him down on a steam table and wrestled with and got the gun from him. Okay, a revolver, 8 bullets in it. When you look at the evidence and the whole thing, it seems like somewhere between 12 and 13 shots were fired. Mm. Now, was Robert Kennedy shot from straight from the front? Question. You look at the autopsy, you look at all of it. No, the shots were fired, and one of them point blank, straight from behind and to the right. The last shot, the last headshot, was fired from straight with an angle from below and into the head. From the back, and it was point blank. It was, the barrel touched the skin. You know, there were burn marks on
his
skin.
Yes, you were right.
Skin.
Point blank.
Point blank. So, my daughter would say, "But Dad, why do they think that it was the guy in front of him? He didn't even get close. How could he shoot him from behind?" Very good question. And you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to figure out that there was a second shooter behind him and to the right. You know, I'm not interested in conspiracy theories. I'm interested in conspiracy facts. And this is a no-brainer to this very day. They covered it up, and it's still this poor guy, Sirhan Sirhan, who's spent his whole adult life rotting away in jail for something he did absolutely not do, you know. And it's the same again. You have the plane that hit Pentagon, you know, the hole in that hit where mm-hmm. the plane hit.
Yeah, impact point.
The size
point.
Of yeah. The impact point, the diameter of a missile, okay? It's said that it was a 757. This is a massive plane.
Now they only show the photos after the facade collapsed so that it does look bigger.
Yeah, but still... Still, after the facade, you cannot fit in a plane there.
Of course, but this also goes to prove the fact that the other team members, i.e. media, are doing their job very well as well. They're also professionals.
And that we are so asleep.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
This is the incredible... Because the official story, the up-to-date official story is... that the plane hit, the wings folded, and they entered into this hole and then disappeared due to it evaporated.
Evaporized, man. It was going so fast.
Titanium 6-ton 2 engines. But listen, this is like if I borrow your car and I come home and I've lost it, and you say, "But what do you do? What did you do with the car?" And I said, Well, I reversed into a wall and it vaporized.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to buy it, but that's the thing. The other plane that went down in Northfield, you know, just a hole in the ground. Where is the plane? There is no plane, yeah. No dead bodies, yeah. Nothing.
Yeah.
And people are saying, well, it was shot down. Well, where did it go?
Yeah.
It's just vaporized again. I'm just saying many of these things are no-brainers.
Of course they
it's
are.
Just a matter of... But it can be extremely complicated to figure out how it was carried out. But the basic thing is a no-brainer.
Yeah.
There was a conspiracy. Now let's move forward and see why and who by who and what was the agenda behind it. That's totally different. That's relevant questions. But to sit and still argue, you know, about no, there wasn't. It's like, come on. People.
Tell me. I had that same feeling this afternoon.
I would say that, you know, normally I don't talk about these things. I don't talk about these things with my normal friends. I, you know, normally I'm just totally quiet. I don't mention it. Then when people are really interested, they ask me, then I go for it. You know, if I'm welcome, then I go for it. Because I think that it's a very painful thing to wake up for many people. I mean, the more concrete your mindset is made of concrete, the harder it is for you to wake up and the more painful. And I would say it's almost like when you lose somebody you really love, first you have this total shock and then you just cannot believe it and you start fighting for your belief, saying, no way can this have happened. Then total disbelief. Then the more you get into the fact that it's actually true, then you go into, some people go into anger, some people go into great sadness and sorrow, despair, or they go get totally obsessed about trying to find out more and more and more. And then they go into this very black spiral, you know, where they can't speak about anything else and their friends and family are just like, oh, come on, can you please shut up, you know. And then in the end, hopefully it starts balancing out and you will be able to cope with the facts, but still stand in balance and do something about it. You know, so I would go gentle on people when it comes to these things. I never go into arguments. I never try to persuade anyone. If they're interested, I would bring the facts, then it's up to them.
Yeah, I normally sort of dig in when I get accused of being crazy.
And I'm sure you do.
And it's like, hey, look, just a minute here, okay? You've mentioned conspiracy theorists three times now with tinfoil hat thrown in. Just a minute, please.
Do you know, we're talking about the JFK assassination, and that was right after that the expression conspiracy theorist, that was invented there and used ever since. They pumped our subconscious. If you say conspiracy, people will say theorist right away. They would finish your sentence. Yep. And I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I'm talking about a
fact.
Conspiracy.
Yeah, and
conspiracy fact. As soon as you add the word theory, conspiracy theory, there's a doubt, you know?
Yep.
There's a doubt. And that's why they want to get that in there so that they can... ridicule people, like any people who really start looking for the truth.
Yeah,
I mean, many, like I said, so many of these are no-brainers to start with, and then complicated to really find out what happened.
Yeah. But, my point of discussion today actually was the Port Arthur massacre here in Australia, in Tasmania.
Yeah,
I
don't know so much about it. I've heard about it, but. What I've heard from is very typical false flag operation following the whole...
You would recognize the template, that's for sure. This probably had a little sort of added down under twist to it.
I'm sure local spice.
Yeah, but sold off as, once again, the lone crazy. And that led to guns being handed in, change of gun laws.
This is the whole idea. They use this problem, reaction, solution.
Oh, very, very quickly. And it's Australia's quite an obliging country, really. Not much is done. People listen, people do. And I sometimes think, well, maybe that's why we were let out of the 2008 financial meltdown, that we were complying with everything, so it was okay. Getting back to Dealey Plaza, what what movie did you watch to identify these people? Because I've tried to find a decent one like this Zapruder film, and I just don't get very long footages, and I don't get to see like the other camera team that was there. Is that correct?
No, but you can't find these things in movies or things. It's a massive jigsaw puzzle that takes decades to put together. But if you're talking about film, people with cameras filming the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
just if you look at the Zapruder film, then there are many different variations of it. It's cut in different sort of on the height, and if you get
cropped.
Hold of one, it's been cropped. But if you can get hold of one where it's not totally focused on the final headshot, but mm-hmm. that so that there's you can see the top of the image as well, you will see that there are two people right at the area when the final shot headshot is fired.
Mm-hmm.
Two people, black suits, white shirt, black tie. There are two on that side. There are some people throwing themselves to the sides on the lawn, you know, when the shots are fired. These two people stand very, very cool and just keep filming it. And on the other side of the street, identical position, there's another one filming the whole thing. And then you got Abraham Zapruder. These three ones with the film cameras have never been identified as, when it comes to identities, neither have these films ever been shown as far as I know, but I do have inside information from CIA operatives and so on that they have actually seen this footage being used for education.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Do you think that the Kennedy assassination was also the purge of the real journalist in America?
I don't understand the word purge.
Purge, to clean, to get rid of.
I don't know. I mean, they've taken over the ownership of the media empires and joined them again and again to, so it's under the control of fewer and fewer people. And nowadays, it's I would say everything except a big part of the alternative media is totally controlled by them. On my website, I've got one link called Lame Media, where I put together where you can see just the exact same message being said on. Word by word on so many of these different TV channels. I've just cut it together so you can see it. And even speeches, you know, in the parliament in Canada and in London, mm-hmm. the identical speech being presented, you know, word by word and by word. This is why groups like the Bilderberg Group and so on are so important to expose so that people become aware of who are the members, who's the hidden agenda and so on, because it's only by really exposing these groups that you will start seeing how this secret, hidden world government is working and who's part of it.
But do you think that the really important people have broken away from the Bilderberg and formed their other little anonymous group because Bilderberg now has their web page and they say, we're going to meet here and yada, yada?
No, that was 2012, 2013, when they couldn't deny it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, they hired a German public relationship company to give them a good image thing. You know, when you couldn't deny it anymore, let's go public.
Yeah.
No, we're just a nice bunch of people sitting here having a chat and a biscuit, you know, and mm-hmm. just a nice little talk. So they're trying to do this with this cozy, nice little club, but absolutely not true. Very sinister agenda when you look into it.
Yeah, and so wide-ranging. Another question I've got is that I've come across someone who says that they took the final headshot out of a gutter drain.
Yeah, there are these theories, yes.
Which I just took as being totally incorrect because it's the wrong trajectory. It's too low.
There are different discussions about this, but I would say I think there were more shooters there that day than shots fired. I think there were shooters that did not fire or hit.
Mm.
So I think this is one of the it's right on what is called the grassy knoll, where the steps goes down. Right beyond that, that is where this manhole is with a lid, and that is from where you could fire a very good shot, where the position for the headshot. Mm-hmm. But I would claim that the final headshot did not come from there. Because now we covered the Dealey, the Daltex building, now we go to the school books depository, and then I moved down. There were people there firing shots, and as far as I've been able to figure out, the people on this sixth floor was, his, one man was Eladio Del Valle. He was a former police officer during the Batista regime on Cuba, and a secret agent that then afterwards was recruited into Operation 40. And he was in that window where Oswald is said to have been. The spotter in that on that floor was a black guy called Herminio Diaz Garcia, also one of the assassins from Operation 40. And the shooter on, it's the same floor, but the window to the all the way to the left, his name was Richard Kane. He was a former police officer from Chicago that had then joined the mob and become one of Sam Giancana, the mob leader in Chicago, one of his closest associates. And he and Sam Giancana had booked in to the Adolphus Hotel, which is, if you like the name, the Main Street and Houston Street, just after the shooting. This man was seen running down from the back of behind the Dallas School Book Depository down Houston Street, like you love to say, and then turned down Main Street and running towards the Adolphus Hotel, which is just a few hundred meters down the street, where I'm sure he hooked up with Sam Giancana. And I also think that it was in that hotel that the whole operation was coordinated from, you know, radio-wise and so on, because there were radio operators in Dealey Plaza in different position. One of them, his name was Jim Hicks, and there were other people as well. Anyway, so that's the school book depository. And I believe that the way they got out, these shooters got out, was that the elevator, just when a minute before this shooting started, the power was cut in the Texas School Book Depository. So the elevator stopped working, and also the whole American phone system was cut out for 1 hour, one solid hour, around this assassination. And this is also standard with these assassination templates. Same with 9/11, same with the 7/7 bombings, and so on. What they want is they want total control of the information coming out from the site, you know. So they shut down so you can't use normal phones, mobiles, nothing like that, until everything is under control from their point of view, and then it's turned on again. But what they did was that they turned off the electricity so that the elevator didn't work. And I believe because there were people walking down the stairs from the upper floors, and they didn't see anyone coming down. They didn't see Oswald either. I mean, he was accused of having been up there. But I believe, since these people were trained in jungle warfare, that they used ropes inside the elevator shaft and just,
abseiled.
Abseiled down, because witnesses saw four people coming out on the back of the building, three of them getting into a car, and the fourth running, that the guy I just described, Houston Street, Main Street, down towards the Adolphus Hotel. And the guy that was waiting for the three other ones, the two other ones, that was the man called David Morales. He, the guy that I described that later shot Che Guevara and so on. He got these two people into a car. He was parked on Houston Street on the wrong side, just at the corner of the Texas School Book Depository. They got in the car, drove off, and then later he came back and most probably picked up Oswald later on. Anyway, so that's the school book depository. Then you continue towards the so-called grassy knoll. On the grassy knoll, you got the Abraham Zapruder, the man that filmed.
He's on the right-hand side of the car.
Yeah, of the car on the right-hand side, exactly, standing up on a cement block, a white block.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little to, if you say that he's on the right-hand side of the vehicle, then a little further down towards the grassy knoll, if you, there's especially one man called Orville Nix, when he filmed the whole assassination, you will see that there's a the back of a car, it's a white, I think it's a Chevy, 1959, that is reversed up against like a white concrete wall. And next to that, there's one shooter. As far as I've been able to find out, this name, the name of the shooter is, his name is Clyde Forshaw. He's still very active as one of the worst serial killers in the world with over 1,000 hits. He to this very day, he's located in Toronto with his friend Walter Tobinski, who I'm going to describe very in just a minute or so. And they are still active, you know, like doing bank robberies. He goes under the name of the Geezer Bandit, the Volta Bandit, and so on. But he and Walter Tobinski have been, as far as I know, part of the cleanup team who have taken care of so many of these witnesses and people who knew too much. They around many of the major assassinations. They're still active. I mean, they must be in the 70s. They were, Clyde is born for 43, so he's 71, and Tobinski is a few years older. Because opposite the Umbrella Man, do you remember the Umbrella Man I told you about, the one that showed the exact site for the crossfire?
Triangulation Man.
That's the guy. In front of him, there's a guy, they call him sometimes the waving guy. He's a Cuban, and he almost steps out in the street waving, you know. I think maybe he even steps out in the car to try and slow it down as well. His name was Felipe Vidal Santiago, and he was part of Operation 40. But he later worked under the alias of Charles Morgan for a CIA front cover, a cover company called ITT. And his tasks were to go to whatever country they were going to carry out an assassination and try and recruit local people to become the patsy or become the shooter or whatever. And he was in Stockholm just a few months before the Olof Palme assassination, trying to recruit shooters in Stockholm. Okay, so there you got a direct contact, a direct proof, a red thread between Dealey Plaza and the hit 23 years later in Stockholm. Felipe Vidal Santos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, but on the other side of the street, if you look at the Zapruder film, just when Kennedy gets hit the first shot in the throat, when you see his arms goes up, stop the frame there, look up on the other side of the street, you will see that there's this guy, a blonde guy, with khaki-colored trousers and a white shirt, and a big, big bulletproof vest. I mean, it's not discreet in any way. It's massive. It's dark brown or black. And this guy, I believe, and he has been identified by witnesses as Walter Tobinski. Now, if you see the frames, what he claims to have told a witness that I know is that when Kennedy went around the street, he had this tranquilizer gun. This is his version, not mine. And that his job was to fire this at Kennedy so that he would be not able to move around, you know, that he would get totally stationary in the car so that they could get the headshot. They wanted the headshot. So if you look at it, what he does is he goes like in a tactical stance almost. It's just like 1 or 2 meters from the limo, and then with something, a black type of weapon, and it looks like he fires it, and then he just let it, his arms drop down the side of his sides. This guy, later, there's some photos just seconds after the limo has disappeared, after the final headshot, and you see there's like a big press bus that is moving, and in that photo, you will see this guy with a massive big black or dark brown bulletproof vest walk towards the Texas School Book Depository. This Walter Tobinski has also been identified as the person who was imitating Lee Harvey Oswald or trying to he went to the Cuban and Russian embassy in Mexico City saying that he was Lee Harvey Oswald applying for a visa and so on, but was denied it. And then the CIA took photos of him coming out from there.
You can see these photos. This is bringing attention to the patsy.
They were trying to paint him black, you know, and really point him out, that this was a communist conspiracy. But this Walter Tobinski, you can see it in the JFK movie. They're showing photos of Walter Tobinski when he comes out from the embassy. That's the guy. Okay.
Okay.
So he was on that side. He was on that side. And I believe there's a man in a silver colored suit behind him with a hat. He's an it's African American, and I believe that is he looks like African American, but I think that is Orlando Bosch, this super terrorist that I explained in my book Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. Just to show what type of people we are talking about, I've got like page up and page down, page up, page down, page up, page down, with the things that he was convicted for and later pardoned by George Bush.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
Unreal.
Yeah.
But, and then in Dealey Plaza, not doing anything, but just being like spectators, there were people, assassins like Freddy Largo. You had Guillermo Posada, you had like Orlando Bosch was there as well, and many of these people were in that tiny little square. Okay, so we move down, we go back to the other side of the street, up to where the car was parked and the shooter was next to the car, and you will see that just the seconds after the headshot, that car is gone. So as soon as the shots are fired, that car starts leaving, and that you can see there's one photo where a man with this very light-colored shirt and trousers are moving away towards the car to get out of the area. But we've got the final headshot left, and the headshot, as far as I know, was fired by a man called James Files. He was stood on the other side of the picket fence, very close to a tree, and he was on the, if you look from the limo, he was on the right-hand side of the tree, getting a perfect angle for the headshot. Now, James Files, his controller was David Attlee Phillips. If you remember David Attlee Phillips from Operation 40. Now, David Attlee Phillips, who was later the chief of the Western Hemisphere for the CIA, and so central in hundreds and hundreds of assassinations. He was, like I say, he was the controller of James Files, one of the shooters. He was also the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, believe it or not. And he was also the controller of a man a few years later, he was recruited. His name was Michael Vernon Townley. And Michael Vernon Townley was in Stockholm 23 years later, part of the team that took out Olof Palme. Mm-hmm. Another major one. Mm-hmm. And when Michael Townley was sent in 1973 to be part of taking out Salvador Allende, President Salvador Allende, and help with the overtake, the coup d'etat that Colonel Pinochet did, with a backup of Henry Kissinger and Operation 40 and the whole shebang down there. When Townley was down there, one of the tasks that David Attlee Phillips gave him was to create two groups of assassins to track down supporters of Allende. And they went globally and just assassinated them big time. Two of the members in these groups of assassins one of them were Roberto Tieme, and the other one, his name was Julio Izquierda Mendenes, yes. These two people were also on location in Stockholm 23 years later. I mean, what are the chances? chances? What are the chances? And this, when Palmer was shot, it was when the winter holidays were on. I mean, Stockholm was more or less empty because everybody was in different parts of the country going skiing and so on. And all of these people were there on site when Olof Palme was taken out, you know? So we go back to Dealey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And now James Files, if I can go into a little detail about him, because he's still alive and he's in prison. He has come forward against his own will, but been persuaded to explain what happened and so on. Some people doubt him. I've looked into for years and years and years the details around this guy. I find him totally trustworthy, except for the amount that he was paid for the assassination. That's the only thing that has differed over the years.
Okay.
But he...
What, by more or less?
He started saying less. But that was when he didn't trust the people. I mean, no wonder this guy was under a lot of pressure in prison, being targeted by the CIA, by the FBI. Everybody wanted him to shut up, you know. So no wonder that he was under a lot of pressure and that he might have changed the amount that he was given for it. But his stories, his details about it has never changed. But his background story is very interesting because... he was, when he was 16, he grew up in Chicago and his sister was murdered by a man. So when he was 16, he got a shotgun, went up and blew the head off the guy who killed his sister. Then he went straight and was enlisted to the army. He then went to the 82nd Airborne Division, became a paratrooper and so on. And it's the same group from... If you've seen the series Band of Brothers, it's the exact same division, the 82nd Airborne. And after that, he was sent to, I think it was Vietnam. And in Vietnam, there was some situation that I'm not really sure what happened, but he executed two of his own people. They were taken by the enemy, I think, and he had to execute them. Anyway, he shot them. And afterwards, when he came back, he managed to get out and came back, and he was in a military hospital where he was taken under evaluation, you know, to see his mental status and so on because what he had done. And he was there approached by Ted Shackley from Operation 40 and later recruited by David Attlee Phillips. You know, the same people pop up here again. Mm-hmm. And what they did was that they took him under their wings. And so he worked partly for the CIA, but he was also recruited by the mob in Chicago where he grew up. And the man that recruited him for the mob was Chucky Nicoletti, if you remember the shooter in the Daltex building.
Mm-hmm.
He was the head hit guy for the head of the Chicago mob. When Chucky Nicoletti saw this guy, he saw that he was very, very good with guns and very, very good with cars. So he recruited him to be his driver and to take care of his weapons and so on. So James Files did that for quite a few years. And then in the summer of 63, Chucky Nicoletti was called to a meeting where Johnny Rosselli and other people were meeting up. And when he came out there, he said that, "Are you up for a hit? Because we have been asked to take part of an assassination. It's going to be on the big guy." Okay, so Files had no idea who he was talking about, but he was totally in because he adored this Chucky Nicoletti. I mean, he really, really admired this person. And Nicoletti had used him for many assassinations they'd done together, you know, mob hits and so on. So... the task that James Files was given was to drive down from Chicago to Dallas with a car filled with weapons, ammo, all of these things. And also he brought a special weapon that he had used a couple of times before. It was a Remington Fireball. It's a weapon. It is built like a rifle, but it's very short. So it's like a very long pistol with a pistol grip. But with the power of a rifle. It's a .222, very, very high velocity and so on, and with a scope. And this was developed by the CIA together with Remington for special assignments, assassinations. And since Files was under the supervision of Attlee Phillips, he was given this weapon. And so he was not prepared to be part of the killing itself, but he always prepared himself for whatever. So he went to a man, a weapons expert that the mob used in Chicago. His name was, he was called the Wolfman. And what they did was they drilled the top of the bullets, because this weapon had a very bad habit of, if you went for a headshot, that the bullet would not enter, but just do a ricochet or whatever it's called.
Ricochet.
Ricochet. So what they did was they drilled the top of the bullet and then filled it with mercury and filled it up then with wax, so that on impact, it would just absolutely make the head explode. And also that would make it impossible to find any pieces of the bullet to make ballistic evidence and so on. So it's the perfect weapon for an assassin. So he brought this weapon in a little, like a small suitcase, briefcase, and drove down to Dallas. In Dallas, he went to a motel just outside in a little part of outside the outskirts of Dallas. It's called Mesquite. And he had been instructed to go to a motel called the Lamplighter Hotel. It's still there. And when he came there, he just phoned in, and he phoned Chucky Nicoletti saying, "I'm here in position." And then he called David Attlee Phillips because that he was his controller, and that was he was supposed to always give a report where he was and so on. So the very next day, he was there like 5 days ahead. The very next day, Lee Harvey Oswald comes and knocks on the door. And the only one that can have informed Oswald about him being there is David Attlee Phillips, the controller of both of them. And Lee Harvey Oswald had been informed to take Files and show him Dallas, but from a point of view, you know, when it comes to escape routes, how to check the whole thing to avoid dead ends, to be aware of train crossings, where there would be traffic blocks or all of these type of things. So they drove around for days, a few hours every day. Also, he went with Files and showed him a place where he could test out the different weapons and so on. So Lee Harvey Oswald was very aware of that an assassination was about to take place, but he was like a double agent trying to stop it. That is there are lots of signs on how he tried to get it out there that an assassination attempt was going to take place. But anyway, on the day of the assassination itself, on the morning, they had come, Chucky Nicoletti and other teams of the hit team had come from Arizona. They were driving in there. They were supposed to fly, but the luggage with all the weapons was too heavy. So they drove there, and they arrived very early in the morning. They were supposed to stay at the Cabana Hotel, which was owned by Doris Day, the singer, and her husband. And Files come there, but instead of picking up Chucky Nicoletti, Johnny Rosselli, do you remember the liaison between the CIA and the mob? Mm-hmm, he came out, and he said, he just jumped into the car, and he said, "Drive me to Fort Worth." So they drove there, and they stayed when they entered the city. On the left-hand side, there was a pancake house, and he said, "Just stop there." He said, "Are you armed?" And Files said, "Yep, always." So he said, "Okay, you just keep in the background, cover all exits and so on. If something bad goes down here, just cover my back." So Files go in there, and Rosselli meets a person, and that person was Jack Ruby, who later killed and murdered Lee Harvey Oswald in the police station. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they met because Ruby was one of the team leaders for this whole assassination. He and E. Howard Hunt were the team leaders for some of the hit teams, you know. And it was like a 5-minute meeting where there was an exchange of money and an envelope. So Ruby left, and then Rosselli and James Files went out into the car. They drove back to Dallas, and in the car, Rosselli opened the envelope, and inside there was some Secret Service ID, you know, badges, and also a map over Dealey Plaza and the route, the changed route, you know, right in front of the building, how they changed the whole thing. So they came back to the Cabana Hotel. We are now at around 10 in the morning or something like that, an hour and a half before the assassination, something like that. And he drops him off outside the hotel. He also he notices Hale Braden that he's seen before. That was the LA mobster who let the people into the Deltex building. He was at that hotel as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chucky Nicoletti gets into the car. They drive to Dallas. And they park the car on the backside of the Deltex building so that he reverses the car up against the building so that Nicoletti and Rosselli can get out through the back door and into the car without being noticed. And then at that point, it's obvious that Rosselli refuses to be one of the shooters. So Nicoletti asks James Files, who he trusts, he says, would you be okay being my backup? And Files says, I would be honored to. I mean, these people did not care who they killed. You know, precedent is just a matter of getting more money. No emotional thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, no problem at all. And then he got positioned behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. And what James Files describes is that he was standing there quite like half an hour before. And he's one of the guys being observed by Lee Bowers, the witness up in the tower on the parking lot, behind on the side of the Texas School Book Depository.
This is near in the rail yard. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the guy. Mm-hmm. That's the guy. He was later killed in a very mysterious car accident. But he observes a young guy and an older guy, which I believe that the older guy, a little heavyset, I believe that is very probable that it was Jack Ruby he saw and James Files behind the picket fence the minutes beforehand. Anyway, so Files was there, and what he did was that he opened the little case with a fireball and just held it down. He had a jacket on that could be turned inside out, so it was... a silvery on the outside, and then if you turn it inside out, it had like a plated pattern. He also had a hat on, and so he had it on silvery color out before, and then just after the shots, he turned it inside out and got the plate. No, the other way around. Plated first, silver afterwards. Anyway, he was standing behind, and the whole thing, he had no idea about the other shooters, the other teams. At least that is what he says. So he was all the time checking out the area, you know, seeing are there any people here that could be undercover cops or that armed or, you know, that can interrupt the whole thing. And then he sees the motorcade coming around the corner. And when they make this awful turn on towards Elm Street, that and everybody's looking in direction, that is when he pulls out the gun. He just rested on the picket fence and follows the limo. It's only like a shot, you know, when the final shot is fired, it's only like 15 meters or less, very, very close-up turkey shoot, you know. But he had been instructed about Chucky Nicoletti, do not fire unless absolute necessary. So when the shot started being fired, he was counting the shots, not like one, two, three, he was counting them like miss, 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 because he could see that Kennedy was being hit, mm-hmm. but not in the head. So he waited and waited and waited. And then this incredible thing happened that the driver of the limo stopped the car almost. For some reason, I do not know how they got him to do that, if he was under mind control or whatever, because the car was being pumped full with bullets from all different triangles. But he stopped, instead of speeding off as soon as the shot started being fired, he stopped it. He braked and the whole limo came to almost like a full stop. And at that point,
was he a regular driver?
Yeah. Bill Greer, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
But the Secret Service team that day was acting very, very oddly. They were partying to way up to 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, getting really, really drunk in Fort Worth, and nobody hardly was reacting against this thing about them being pulled away and leaving the president. Yeah, open. So the Secret Service was very much part of this whole thing.
But there was there's a footage of one of the Secret Service guys being quite annoyed to get off the car.
Yeah, that's at the airport.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then when the shots are fired, another guy, his name was Clint Hill, he ran forward and jumped up on the rear of the limo when it took off, and then got Jackie to crawl into the car again because she was trying to get hold of part of the piece of a skull of the skull of her husband.
Oh, incredible!
Yeah, disgusting.
There's evidence of about 13 bullets, isn't there?
There's a lot of bullets. It's very hard to know exactly how many and so on. But James Files, anyway, when the car came to a full stop and nobody had done a headshot, he just said, okay, fine. So just when he fired, he was looking through the scope very close up and he was aiming for the right eye. And when he fired, just a tenth of a second before, he saw the head being blown forward because it seems like Chucky Nicoletti got a headshot from the back, and then he pulled the trigger and hit not the eye but in the right temple,
mm-hmm.
and just blew the whole head off.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, when the limo took off, he just very quickly bent down, put the gun in the gun case, turned his jacket inside out, put the hat on, and then walked along on the inside of the picket fence behind the school book depository, over the street, Houston Street, into the car where Nicoletti and Rossetti was already in it. They didn't mention anything at all about them. And then he took off. That's not true because Nicoletti criticized him for being that he did it a bit over the top. But that was the only thing they ever mentioned about this.
That was actually the one suspicious shot, obviously suspicious shot.
This is the one that has messed the whole thing up.
Yeah.
The whole thing, that's the final headshot. Without that, we would still be at square one to a great extent. But this, I tell you, sometimes I feel that God has a sense of humor because somehow, right when it's supposed to happen, something gets messed up that shows that, you know, that gives an indication that something is not right here.
Mm-hmm.
It's again and again.
Yeah, they're not
so
perfect.
That was never. And I've spoken to real assassins that have informed me about these things, and they also say that they have almost like staff meetings before an operation and then a follow-up staff meeting where they go through. If the effect has not been exactly what they wanted, then they follow up with a second conspiracy, a follow-up thing, and that is also what you can see very often, mm-hmm. at these events, that one thing happens one day and then it's like there's a secondary thing happening the following day.
There's a flow-on effect thing. Yeah,
it's almost like an echo of the thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Max,
yes,
that's all for today.
The man of many that has so many names in his head, an incredible story, and highlighting the fact of how much is out there, how many questions there are regarding that. Also highlighting the fact like I mentioned earlier, the team player called the media that plays along and enables that same old story to be explained with yearly rituals that only ever explain that story and they never go beyond that.
Mm.
Ola Demogod, once again, please give everyone your web address and anything else you'd like to finish off with.
My website is called Light on Conspiracies. One of my books is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. I've written several books in different on different topics, but that's the one that is concerning this. In one of the last chapters, you will see Operation 40 being described in great details and how it's connected with so many of these assassinations. But the main part, the starting point, it's the assassination of Olof Palme, but with all the different tentacles going into the Iran-Contras, to illegal arms trading international, into the Bilderberg group, into the whole Freemasonry set, the whole shebang. And if somebody would like to support me, I've done this for about 30 years. I'm just an ordinary guy who's doing my utmost to expose what's going on, to help create a better world for us all. If somebody would like to support my efforts, there's a donation button. There's possibilities to sign up for my newsletter, which is a great help for me, and also a way to follow what I'm doing closely. And it's a monthly newsletter. Or sign up as a member. And or buy my book, whatever. It's financial support that is the one that I lack, just so that I can be able to focus on this. And if it's okay with you, I would like to end with a prayer.
Yes, please do, Ola. Please do.
I'm not a religious person, but I feel as a spiritual being. There's this prayer that I really love, and it goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light.
Interview Ola Demogorgon.
Well, this week, this is someone that we have heard on Fire in the Sky before. Ola Demogorgon, who was with us previously in regards to a coup d'etat in slow motion. Ola is back this time in regards to follow-on stories of the murder of Olof Palme, with Operation 40, something that he has worked on quite extensively. Good afternoon to you, Ola.
Good afternoon to you, Pi Radio, Mr. Max.
As we know from your previous interview, you've studied extensively on the murder of, or I should say the assassination of Olof Palme. And a lot of the names that you've discovered in your investigation in that have also appeared in other areas, other assassinations, other events. The best place to start would probably be your book, I would say.
Well, my book is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, and you can find it on my website, Light on Conspiracies, lightonconspiracies.com. And I've devoted about 30 years of my life into trying to reveal what is the real truth behind many of these historical events that we've been, where we've been presented a version that doesn't really make sense, and that turns out, the more you look into it, that it's a mess of absolute lies. And I've dug very, very deeply into the JFK assassination, the Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. And this has also led me into many different areas, as 9/11, Oklahoma City, the Boston bombing, the beheading in Woolwich, many, many of these assassinations worldwide. And not to polish my halo, but I've been welcomed as one of the world-renowned world experts on the JFK assassination, false flag operations, and assassinations globally. So just to show I'm not a bullshitter. One of the things I found was this Operation 40 that you, Max, you just mentioned here. And it's like what I found without knowing, when I looked very deeply into many of these so-called terror acts and assassinations, was that they're actually connected. I had absolutely no idea about that to start with, but the more deep I have dug into the hidden truth behind them, the more it has pointed straight back to the same group again and again and again. And this is the so-called global elite, they call themselves. I would call them the minority or the lightless, but they prefer the global elite. And many, if not all, of these assassinations and so-called terror acts have been part of their agenda, which is to centralize the power globally to the hands of fewer and fewer people, with the aim of creating a one global state without borders. But this is not like the Garden of Eden, but what they're trying to create is a one world fascist state with a one world army that is a product made from the NATO troops and the UN troops combined. This is an army that is not there to protect the population of the world, but to control it. They want a one world digital currency. It's very important for them that it's digital, because as soon as there's no real money around, paper money, then the one that controls your credit card or chip or whatever it is that will be, control money in the future, can just turn you off. If you do not stand in line and follow the rules, they can just turn you off, so that you have absolutely no means of making an income, surviving, or buying anything.
Because by that time, that chip would be your entry into your workplace and exit, I would also imagine.
This is the thing. They want the whole world to be microchipped, or not themselves, but the rest of us, microchipped, so that they would have total control over us. These microchips would be inserted on top of the hand or somewhere else on the body. And you can just use like a scanner, in like the ones they use in the supermarket, and just pull it over the chip. And in the chip, you can have thousands and thousands of pages of documents, medical reports, criminal records, everything, you know. And also, this would be with a GPS, so that they can see where you move, where you go, who you meet, and also control entrance into buildings, exits, you know, control your working hours, everything, absolute everything. This is one of the targets. They want total control. And this is what they're...
It doesn't seem that far away either. I was speaking to someone only a couple of weeks ago, and they were telling me about one of their friends that has a chip to get into a nightclub.
This is the way they do it. They start like that, you know, in the States and Sweden and so on. They make it really cool, you know. Oh, the guy with the chip, he can come in, you know. Only the VIP will be allowed chipped. But also what they do is they chip foreigners, they chip prisoners, and that's the way to go. Now they do it through insurance companies. So they say, you will not be able to get an insurance for your child if she or he is not microchipped, because it's only with a microchip then we can see if the child disappears and so on. And they do it with car insurances, so that the car will be chipped, your passport will be chipped, you know, everything, the vehicle itself is chipped. They're trying to get it down into a smaller and smaller chip where everything is collected in one little place, and that would be the chip inside your body that you cannot dispose of.
Right, and then I would imagine that would all link into the smart grid.
Of course, this is the whole thing. I tell you, as soon as they call it smart, watch out. Mm-hmm. Smart meters, smart TVs, smart grid. It is smart from their point of view, absolute disastrous for us. Smart meters is one thing I really would encourage people to look into, because that is a horrific invention that they're just pushing on us without most people even knowing about it.
No, here in South Australia, the energy companies aren't yet trying to say they're mandatory, but most people have them now, because when they sign up to get a rebate or any government help obtaining solar panels, that automatically includes a smart meter.
It's awful. It's awful when you look at what it's doing. Not only that it's controlling, it can, I mean, through the smart meter, they can see how many times you use the fridge, when they use the phone, when you surf the internet, you know, when your computer is on, off, when you take a shower, where you surf, when you watch TV. But even worse than that is that it's also very, very a major risk to your health. There's a lot of studies made where you can see that if you are close to one of these smart meters, your red blood cells get hammered. They really get smashed up, you know. So if you stay for a longer time close to one of these, you can get really, really seriously sick.
Mm-hmm.
There's one documentary, I think it's called Take Your Power Back, that is about smart meters, and it shows very clearly what the whole thing is about and how the authorities, this is made in the States mostly, and I mean, there they just break in. They don't even knock on the door. They break into your basement and replaces the old analog meter with a smart meter without asking, without doing anything. And it's just like people do not understand what's going on. They have no idea. Here in Spain, they're doing it. They don't tell people. They don't inform anyone. It's just upgraded, you know. We're back to this beautiful
book. Yes, we were mentioning that before the interview, the wonderful upgrade.
Yeah, for your sake, it's for your safety, for your benefit. But what most people don't know either is also that the price they pay, it's said that the smart meter will cut your costs, but more or less everyone who gets one installed get an additional cost on top. Many people have like almost double the charge for the electricity and so on after they get these installed. And they can fight forever with the companies to try and get it sorted, and they're not really getting anywhere. So watch out for these smart things, smart phones, smart TVs, smart meters. It's just a fancy word of saying
control you. Yep.
It's a control you meter. It's a control you TV. It's a control you phone. It's a control you. Mm-hmm. This is the one. So stay away from them if you can.
I'm doing my best personally, that's for sure.
Thanks. Now, we are here. Here in Spain, we're trying, you know, we're a small little group that are trying to make like templates that people can fill in and then send to the energy company just saying, we will not have one. And use the right legal terms so that you can get out of it, because they claim it's mandatory, but it's not.
It's not by law.
They just use the word and it's absolutely not true.
Yeah, they're just going for the corporate leverage, hoping that no one's going to question.
That's the one.
Do you find that the economic problems or the austerity plan in Spain that's working towards the introduction of smart meters?
I do not understand the question.
The whole economic crisis that Spain has had, has that fed into the introduction of smart meters?
I don't know, because officially I haven't heard about smart meters at all. I've just seen them being installed, you know.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Just like, yeah, it's like I haven't seen anything. People don't know about them. And then suddenly I walk by a building and suddenly I see this beeping, this red light, ding, ding, ding. So I started looking in. I'm like, oh, my God, what have they done? Where did this come from? I start asking the owners of the property. They had no idea. No, it's the power company. They just upgrade, and they don't ask or tell you or anything. As far as I know, I think it's done totally covertly, you know, without people knowing. They try to do it so that people won't notice until it's too late. The plan is to get everything in place before 2018 here, as far as I know.
Okay. And are you getting a response from people?
As far as I know, 99.5% have absolutely no idea that they even exist.
Wow.
So that's why we're a small little group trying to get some kind of organization going or create a website where people can download templates for these papers that they can send in and just refuse to accept them and so on. So it is a secret war. Like this globally, specialist in COVID wars that people are not aware of. But it's just they're coming from so many different directions, you know, water, air, food, electricity, through the media, through everywhere at the moment. So it's a challenging time.
It certainly is a challenging time and an extremely interesting time to be on the third rock from the sun. Now, going back to 1963, the 22nd of November and the assassination of Kennedy, what names or what connections have you found that link back to the assassination of Olof Palme?
I tell you, many people, they ask me, why do you even bother with a murder that long ago? I mean, why is it of any interest? Why even bother, you know? But the thing is that on the 22nd of November that year, it was not only the murder of a single person that happened to be a president. It was a very brutal takeover of the United States by a very violent group of people, a power constellation that took over the power there and have stayed in power ever since. I would, with 30 years down the line in research, I totally claim that all the presidents that have followed since then have been just a different face on the same very brutal war machine that took over that day. And then they just changed the front person, you know, now his name is Obama. Absolutely no difference when his name was George Bush Jr. or Jimmy Carter, Reagan, all of them come from the same thing. They're just a different front figure. And so this is why I put such an effort in trying to identify who was really involved, what was the interest behind it, what power constellations and structures were behind this whole thing, and how have they continued, and how to expose them so that they will stop attacking us, because they're really going for it, you know. And this is why... you know, when you look at people in the White House and other governmental buildings and so on, you see these white-haired old guys, they look very nice and decent. They didn't just pop up, you know, being 68 or 72 years old. These are people that have proved their loyalty over decades by dipping their hands in blood, many of them, being totally loyal to their agenda, which is absolute death and destruction for such a big part of the rest of the world. So not very nice people, I would say.
Yeah, it was definitely a turning point for the world, and I would also extend it to the English-speaking nations of the world.
I would say the whole world. If that had not happened, I would very strongly claim that the world would look very, very different if this group of people would not have taken over there. It was a coup d'etat, but almost globally. You know, the whole Western world was overtaken there mm-hmm. by these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not the first assassination, but this is the highlight of their career almost. It's one of the best executed assassinations over the decades, I would say, and they use it as an example in schools for assassins and snipers and so on, how to carry out a perfect assassination on a high level. It is not only the CIA, it's the military as well, the whole military industrial complex and the whole structure now with the NSA and so on, how they train mercenaries and assassins. This assassination is being used as a good example on how to carry them out.
Okay.
And in part of how to set a whole assassination, to set it up, they use almost like templates. And this is one of the things I focus on trying to expose to the man in the street globally, so that he will become or she will become more and more aware of how they carry these things out. And so that the next time something like this happens, you won't buy into it that easy. The next time you hear about one of these terror acts and it's a lone crazy guy or a demonized group, then just say, hang on, just wait a second. Let me just check out the facts first. Let me have a look before I just swallow the official story. And even better, the more of us, when millions of us, the way it is now, are waking up and are starting to see the method they use, that makes it so much more difficult for them to carry them out. So my intention is to put the spotlight right on them, saying, we see you, so you don't even try to pull the trigger, you know, we see you. And the sooner we can expose them on an early stage, the bigger the chance are for this madness to stop.
Mm-hmm. And so what were some of the similarities with the assassination in Sweden of Olof Palme?
I tell you, one of the things that I found, it's taken me many, many years to find these connections. But the one thing that I found that connects more or less all of these terror acts and murders are a group that went under the very secret name Operation 40 or Group 40. This was a group that was created under President Dwight Eisenhower. He was not the one coming up with the idea. That was Alan Dulles, the chief of the CIA and other high-ranking CIA officers and so on. And the idea was to create a super secret team of very skilled assassins that could be used globally. Whoever you have problems with, just get rid of them. And this was the team to be used. So the task was given to the vice president at that time, Richard Nixon, to create this group. And he called in some hardened CIA veterans like Ted the Blonde Ghost Shackley, super central in many, many countless assassinations globally on the Western Hemisphere. There were people like David Attlee Phillips, who was later the chief of the for the CIA globally on the Western Hemisphere. I mean, we're talking not amateurs, big-time players. Another one was E. Howard Hunt. Maybe some people will recognize him from being one of the Watergate burglars. But he's also very central in the JFK assassination and hundreds of other assassinations. So these were some of the CIA top people. And what they did was they went to Miami and they started recruiting mostly exiled Cubans that had escaped from Cuba when Castro took over. And these people were mostly former military people from the Air Force, police force, and so on. Very hard, violent people. And so they recruited them and they started training them. They trained them in Louisiana and Miami. They also had a training camp in Guatemala and so on. And they were trained in everything from jungle warfare to, you know, explosives to poisoning people to whatever. As long as if it was about death, they knew how to do it. So the whole idea with this group to start with, there were about 86 people, one woman and 85 men. And the idea was first to take out Fidel Castro, who had come. You know, the Cuba before Castro was an absolute haven for the mob and for the big, big financial interest in the States. You know, the whole casino gambling bit on Cuba was, I think, if you combine Las Vegas and Atlantic City at the moment, that was the way it was. But in the late 50s, unreal the amount of black money circulating there and being pumped into the States or to this little group of elite people.
A lot of people forget the point of where Cuba was in that period.
Cuba is extremely close to the States. You know, it's only, I think, 90 miles offshore from Miami. And so it was a perfect place for also to take drugs into to the States, you know, to get all kind of illegal trading through Cuba into the States. So it was the perfect setup for these power structures, and they had the mob very much involved in the whole thing, you know, so it was a win-win for everyone involved. And then came the bearded guy, Fidel Castro, and just threw the whole thing out. He just said, listen, this island, this country is for the Cubans, not for you, so get out, you know. And he threw everybody out, so there were a lot of people and power interests that got very, very pissed off with this man. So what they did was they said, okay, let's use Operation 40 to take him out. And they did several attacks, they did several attempts, but they never succeeded. Then came the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, when Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, was sending a ship with missiles towards Cuba, and, you know, to get Russian missiles just 90 miles off the shore of Florida and the rest of the States was a major threat. So the States, with Kennedy at the top, they just said, if you cross this longitude, there was a specific longitude, they said, if the ship crosses this, we will start a third world, a nuclear war on you. So back off, or we'll press the button. But by mistake, this message wasn't given to the captain of the ship, and he continued and by mistake crossed that line. So actually, it was a situation where Kennedy more or less was sitting with a finger on the button, being the one that could just blow the whole world to smithereens, you know. And the whole military industrial complex was sitting there just, go, go, go for it, you know, press it, press it. And people who were there say that Kennedy was sitting with tears in his eyes just saying, I refuse to be the one who does this to the world. And from that point, that is my opinion, that that was the point where suddenly Mr. Playboy Kennedy, that was easy to maneuver around for this elite group, you know, and manipulate and was very much into luxury and women and flair and all of these things. From that point, suddenly he became a very, very strong and determined individual who just said, it's time to stop this madness. It is time, you know. So what he decided was to crush the CIA into 1,000 people, pieces. He knocked out he fired three of the holy cows within the CIA, one of them being Alan Dulles. He decided to get out the financial system out of the Federal Bank Reserve, which is unheard of. That is one of the core weapons this elite group have to keep the rest of the world by the throat financially. And that is also the reason why Abraham Lincoln, one of the major reasons he was taken out was because he wanted to get free out of the grip of this so-called Federal Bank Reserve. It's not federal at all. It's a private bank institution. And he also wanted to withdraw out of Vietnam. This was a war that hadn't even started on the American behalf. There was only, I think, some 16,000 military advisors in Vietnam at that point. It was a war that was started with the French and the Vietnam regime. But it was so much a matter of drugs from the Golden Triangle being transported through Vietnam and to the Western world. So by him wanting to withdraw the whole military industrial complex and the people who had big interest in the drug trade and so on, it was just unheard of. And there were many other reasons as well why that he decided, you know, he went for the mob as well. He put his brother Robert Kennedy to track and start like a witch hunt on the mob. Up until then, thanks to E. Howard Hunt, J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the FBI, he had been denying the existence of the mob all the way up until this point, because they had him by the balls, because they had a lot of blackmailing ways of controlling E. Howard Hunt. So he had denied the pure existence of the mob, but when Bobby Kennedy went for them, within 1 year, the percentage of verdicts against mob members went up with 700%. You know, so the mob just was freaked out and very, very upset as well, because especially the Chicago mob had helped Kennedy get into power. You know, there was a very, very close election between him and Richard Nixon. I think it's the closest in the history of the world. And the mob in Chicago supplied some, an additional couple of thousand votes that got him into the White House. So they felt that he really owed them big time for him getting into the White House. So they were also very upset. Anyway, so when he started behaving like this, a decision was taken. Very hard to say exactly when and where this decision was taken, because it's hidden in like big smoke clouds of smoke, you know, in way up in the power pyramid. But there was a conspiracy starting to take shape where they wanted to get rid of Kennedy. And they wanted to statue an example. That's why they killed him out in the open, right in front of people, right in front of cameras and so on, to make a statement saying that we can get anyone at any time, anywhere, So whoever you are, if you are considering, you know, standing up against us or becoming whistleblowers or whatever, you'd better back off. That was the message they said, sent out. And this is a recurring thing when people start becoming whistleblowers or, you know, when they need to just push people back in line, they commit a murder like this in out in the open, very, very obvious for the people who in the corridors of power, who are behind it. They don't know the details, but they know the power behind these assassinations. And this is why I would say that very often when there is a major conspiracy, there's almost like a secondary conspiracy of silence that follows. It's the official story or nothing. And, well, so when it came to taking JFK out, they used everybody involved had to, just like when the old Romans killed Julius Caesar, he was stabbed from, I think, 13 different senators, so that everyone that was behind the assassination also dipped his hand in blood, making it impossible for him to blame anyone else without going down himself. And this is what they did here as well. Everyone involved had to supply shooters. And so there were shooters delivered from the Chicago mob, from the mob in New Orleans. And a major part of this was from Operation 40. They also imported some very skilled assassins from France, who was taken in by the mob. And so the whole thing was that it was totally compartmentalized. So many of the shooters who was taking part of this didn't even know about the other shooters. They were only aware of their little part. But this Operation 40, after they pulled off the JFK assassination, they were, since they were so successful with that, they were being used then over decades. They have been the core group in assassinations like the Robert Kennedy assassination. They were part of Martin Luther King, that assassination. They were part of the overtake of Salvador Allende in Chile and the murder of thousands down there. They were part of training a lot of the people as torturers and executioners. They were part of blowing up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C. With a car bomb. They were part of killing a top guy in South Africa by the name of Robert Smith. They were also part of taking out Olof Palme 23 years later in Stockholm, and they were part of killing Uwe Barschen in Germany, and so on. It just goes on and on and on and on. These people have been extremely active for decades and decades, and over the years, this group has it's changed its name, you know, in many different constellations, and for every operation, it got a new name and so on. But the core members have stayed. And they're also very, very central in the so-called Iran-Contra scandal, where there were weapons from the National Guard being smuggled out from the States, being delivered to the Contras army down in Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, and so on. And when the planes, there were big army planes or medevac helicopters and so on, when they went back, they were filled up with cocaine and mostly cocaine and taking back and starting the whole crack epidemic in the States. The whole thing that was designed to make billions for these people and at the same time destabilize the American society with more and more crimes, more and more weapons, more and more people in the minorities killing each other, but also to get be able to put more and more people into privately owned prisons owned by the same people and make absolute billions there as well. But I want to go back to the creation of Operation 40, because the guy that was put in charge of the finances, the one that collected money from companies like Standard Oil, United Fruits, but also the military industrial complex, oil tycoons in Texas and so on, his name was George Herbert Walker Bush. He was a very young man at the time. But he was the guy set to fund this whole thing. His father, Prescott Bush, was doing the exact same thing years earlier. But that at that point, it was to get the funds to Adolf Hitler. and into the IG Farben, the whole chemical giant, who was, you can almost put like the IG Farben equals the Nazi war machine. You know, it's that much. So George Herbert Walker Bush, he was, his right hand in this operation was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. This Felix Rodriguez is very central in the Iran-Contra scandal. He's also in the Watergate burglary. He was also sent to track down a man by the name of Che Guevara, who was one of the Fidel Castro's close associates. He was sent down to Bolivia, where Che Guevara was hiding. And one man that he had some local soldiers, and then one other man from Operation 40 by the name of David Morales. David Morales was later named the top assassin of Latin America. He was also part of the Robert Kennedy assassination. He was in Dealey Plaza when JFK was shot. And he was the one who, on the order of Felix Rodriguez, he was the one that executed Che Guevara. And to this very day, Felix Rodriguez is still wearing Che Guevara's wristwatch. Very proud of that one. So these people are so central in so many things, including the assassination of John Lennon and the attack on Bob Marley and so on. If you want to, I can go into details about these assassinations as well.
Oh, if we can a bit later. I'd like to stay with Kennedy because it's something that, like you said, people have tend to really file away and not think about anymore, even to the point of a national radio presenter here in Australia quite openly saying, and I quote, "I can't even see there's a question in regards to the Kennedy assassination," end of quote. And I find I can't understand it. You don't have to look very far before you come across questions. There's so many.
Okay, if you want to, I can go through the shooters and the positions and who were there and who were doing what. Is that something you would like?
Yeah, that would be good.
Okay, the thing is that for people who don't know the layout of Dealey Plaza, it's a very quite odd location. If you look from an aerial point of view, it's almost like you got the main street going from downtown Dallas, going straight up. So if you see, for instance, if you imagine like a pyramid shape, they love to do killings in symbolic places. And very often this pyramid shape, when it comes to streets and so on, are very obvious. I'm not sure this is the case here, but I'm just describing it. So we got Main Street. If you imagine that going up straight through the bottom in the center of the pyramid up to the top, that's Main Street. Then the bottom of the pyramid, that is, I forgot, Houston Street. And then if you make a right turn there, so you come from Main Street, then you go straight to the right 90 degrees on Houston Street, and then you do a 120-degree turn to the left down Elm Street. And it's about 100 meters further down the road where the last final headshot was fired, right outside or not far from the so-called Texas School Book Depository, and further down the road, the so-called Grassy Knoll. So what happened this day was that this was actually not the first place they planned. They had planned to take him out in Miami first. There were also plans to take him out in Chicago, but this was called off because it was too close to the Chicago mob, that they were afraid that it would be so obvious that they were involved. So when it came to what they wanted was to get him down to Texas, because in Texas, Vice President Lyndon Johnson and the oil tycoons and the Bush family were extremely powerful in that area. So down there, they would be able to control the whole investigation, control all the key people that would be involved and so on. So they tried to get him down there, and the man they used to that was the governor, John Connally. He was a close associate to Lyndon Johnson, a friend since many years. He was also involved in in some frauds when it came to rigged elections earlier to get Johnson into the position where he was, and so on. So he was the one that managed to get Kennedy down to Texas. And Jackie and John, they flew to Houston and San Antonio, and then it was time for Dallas. They arrived there early in the morning of the 22nd of November. It had rained that day, but when he came there in Air Force One, it was just an absolute beautiful day. This was the south of the south of the south, I mean, redneck country, big time, and they did not like Kennedy. Also, there were some of his political partners that had been down there, Adlai Stevenson and so on, and they had thrown things and then spit at him and threatened him not long before he had to go down there. So this was, you know, enemy territory that he was going down there. But he was a very, how should I say, I don't want to say naive, but he was a very brave, and also he was not backing down, Kennedy. If you challenged him, he would just move forward. You know, he often insisted on meeting normal people in the street, you know, shaking their hands and so on, even though the bodyguard said, no, please don't, you know. He just insisted.
He was his own man.
That's the one. And that's why they couldn't control him in the end, you know. So what they did was they got him down there to Dallas, and instead of the normal procedure, which would be to have like a bulletproof top on the limousine, like a bubble top, they got it off the car by saying, you know, challenging his manhood, more or less, you know, like, well, there's this danger of if you have this on, then maybe, you know, you can get shot and so on. Kennedy just said, well, take it off. I'm here to stand up, you know, in transparency and truth. Take it off. Not sure if the decision was taken by him, but he approved of it. So totally against all security rules, the bubble top was off. And in the car, they tried to get another top politician, but at the last minute, this guy was exchanged for John Connolly and his wife. So there were the driver and the Secret Service guy in the front, and then in the middle seat were John Connolly and his wife, and then in the back seat, the rear seat, was Jackie Kennedy to the left and John Kennedy to the right. Now, normal procedure when it comes to security is that they would be sent in, army specialists, snipers, Secret Service, and so on, weeks ahead, you know, checking the whole area, checking the streets, checking the buildings, securing everything. You know, there would be snipers on the roofs. There would be all windows would be closed, you know, taped and so on, so that there would be absolutely no possibility for an attempt. And if somebody opened a window in a building near to where the limo would passing, there would straight away be people that would take care of it. This day, absolutely nothing happened. There was a phone call made from a high general, just saying to the normal security people, please stand down, we will take care of it. But the result was that absolute no one. And also when they started driving off from the airport, the normal procedure would be that there were bodyguards standing on the sides of the limousine. There would be motorbike, police motorcycles on the front, on the sides, and behind.
Outriders,
making it very difficult for a sniper to get a clear shot.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, when they left the airport, everything was called back, you know, so that there were no Secret Service agents on the car. They were on the follow-up car behind it. And all the police motorcycles, the outriders?
Correct.
Were on behind it, you know, leaving the whole car open, a totally open area for shots being fired from all directions. And also, normally you would put the president limo in the middle of the motor cage, not up front. No way. That you would also have the president's medical team very close to him, so that if anything should happen, they could help him. You know, this car where the doctors were put way back in the end of the motor cage. There would also be like ambulances placed out on different key positions. And this day, just a few minutes before Kennedy arrived, there was a man at Dealey Plaza that had a seizure. So he was picked up by this ambulance, driven to the hospital. And then, so the ambulance was out of the place when the shots were fired. It was down at the hospital. And when they came in with this guy to the hospital, he just stood up and walked off, you know. So it's very, there's a great possibility that this was part of the staged event and that it was just to get the ambulance out of the way.
Okay, yeah, to get also, medical help away from the motorcade. Yeah.
Exactly. Also, standard procedure would also be that the press car with photographers and film, the film crew and so on, would be right up next to the presidential limo so that they could film Kennedy wave and all of it. Most of the time it would be in front of the presidential limo. This time, way back in the motor cage, you know. So all this normal procedure was being pulled away, you know, just like a sacrificial lamb being brought up to slaughter. You just get rid of all the bodyguards, all protection, everything. And this poor lone sod had absolutely no idea what he's up for. So here he was, all the way up in the front. There was only one car in front of it, of the presidential limo, and that was the Dallas sheriff and one of his men, a white car that was showing the route how they should drive. And up until the day when this happened, the idea was that they would drive from downtown Dallas straight along Main Street, that is very, very straightforward, and pass right through Dealey Plaza in the middle of the pyramid, you know, just going full speed ahead or just full, well, speed ahead, but not that fast. And then they would go to the World Trade Center where Trademark Center, where he was supposed to give a speech. But what happened when they arrived to Dealey Plaza, this big open area, it's sort of like a park area with grass and then surrounded by buildings around the sides of the pyramid. When they came to the bottom of this pyramid, the car in front with the police and so on took a right, which is totally against security rules, took a right 90 degrees, and then this awful, awful 120 degree turn to the left down Elm Street, which made the whole motorcade stop more or less, you know. And security-wise, absolute a no, no, no. You know, they're not allowed to go below, I can't remember what it is, but it's a certain number of miles per hour for security. And this one, it just slowed the whole thing up. So not only was he without bodyguards and protection, but they also slowed it down so that it was a turkey shoot. And then, so Kennedy, the motorcade went around that corner, and on that corner there's the Texas School Book Depository, which is where it said that Lee Harvey Oswald was sitting up on the sixth floor in the window to the furthest to the east. And that was where he shot these three shots that they claim. But next to that building, to the right of the building, they're separated by Houston Street, is the so-called Deltex building, where there is, on the second floor, there's a mining, there was a mining company that was a front for a CIA front company. Anyway, so once the motorcade turned around that corner, there were, you know, since the official idea and the thing that you saw in the newspaper was that that the motorcade would go down Main Street, where people were also gathered to see him, all the people that were standing along the alternative route that normal people did not know about are extremely interesting, because why were they standing there if they didn't know that the motorcade would turn around? And once you start studying this crowd that was along, standing along these streets and in the grassy knoll and these different areas, there are so many of them that are assassins involved in Operation 40, mob members, and so on. And the thing was, they called this the Big Event, was the name of this assassination, the Big Event. And I would say it's almost like, you know, if there's a rock concert in London or Stockholm or something, maybe Michael Jackson would come, then all the local rock artists would come there as well, because it's sort of a big event within the rock circus. Well, here was within the assassination circus. Back to the motorcade, when it turned around, turned the corner, this this very lethal 120-degree turn to the left, and started driving down the road. There was one man on the right-hand side of the street, when you can't look from the motorcade, with a black umbrella. He was dressed more or less in black with a black umbrella, which has been, it has caused a lot of rumors about him having a hidden dart gun or a secret weapon inside this. Because why on earth would he stand with an umbrella when it's very sunny and a clear blue sky? In my opinion, his name was Roy Hargraves. He was very closely associated to Operation 40, even though he was not a real member. But he was a mercenary, and I think that his task was to mark the point for the crossfire to start, because they wanted to blame this on one lone crazy guy. So they couldn't have that there was like 20 shots fired during like 30 seconds, because then people, everybody would understand, like, my God, doom, do, 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 do. You can't have that. So it had to be like one, two, three, fire, like an execution squad, you know.
Yeah, a firing squad.
So yeah, a firing squad, exactly.
So he was the triangulation point.
That's the one. That's exactly the correct expression, I would call it. And there were some people nervous, and there were some shots fired right before they came there. But from where he stood and then another 30 meters, there were a lot of shots fired from different directions, because this poor guy was absolutely surrounded by assassins. And if you want, I can just go through the different buildings and where the different shooters are.
Yeah, please do.
If we start in the Deltex building that I explained before, that is right on the corner, opposite the school, Texas School Book Depository, and there's a street in between called Houston Street. But that office I told you about, the mining office, that was a CIA front. There was one guy there from the LA mob. His name was Hale Braden, and his task was to open the back door and let the team for that building into the office building, get them up there and into the office, from where they had a very clear shot on a low projectile, very parallel almost with the street level, just a little bit up, perfect shot for a headshot from the back. The people that entered that building was Ted Shackley, the one, his name, you can see he was arrested afterwards, right afterwards, and went under the name of Larry Flora. But you can compare photos with Ted Shackley, you will see same guy, colored hair. Okay, he was in there. Also, George Bush Sr. was in this office when the shots were fired, the paymaster of Operation 40 at that time. Later, very, very central in the CIA, he became the CIA director of the CIA, vice president, and then president. And you will also see over the years that followed this thing that the many members of Operation 40, when they got caught and put in jail from a lot of these atrocities that they did, they were suddenly pardoned by no one less than George Bush Sr., a very, very sinister figure, this George Bush Sr. And more people in that room was Johnny Rosselli. He was he was a former hitman for Al Capone, but in later years he became sort of like the liaison between the mob, especially the Chicago mob, but also the LA mob, and the CIA. He was sort of the one, he was called the colonel, and he was the one that coordinated a lot of these things. He was planned to be one of the shooters, but in the last minute he got cold feet, out of the last hour, he got cold feet because there was a contradictory order sent out to cancel the operation. And nobody really knew where that came from. So he got confused and said, no, I want to back out. So the task for him as a second shooter was given to a man called James Files that I'm going to go into more details about soon. But the real shooter in that window was a Chicago mob hitman by the name of Charles Chucky Nicoletti, a very, very low-spoken, elegant man, very, very efficient as an assassin and so on. And he was one of Chucky Giancana, one of the top heads in Chicago, mob-wise. He was his private hitman. And he was the shooter, and the spotter, the guy with a, there's always a one with a radio and binoculars. Normally in these hit teams, there can be two or three. One, the shooter, and his task is just to shoot, you know, get the hit, get the guy dead. That's his task. The spotter has to check out the area, check out the escape routes, check that so no one interferes and so on, and also take care of if there's cartridges or anything like that. Very often they have a third person, and that he's called the breakdown guy. They throw the weapon to him as soon as the shots are fired so that the shooter can get out together with the spotter, and then he will take care of the evidence and go the other direction. The spotter in this building, as far as I know, his name was Nestor Izquierdo. He was also part of Operation 40, a black guy who, to this day, he was killed later, but he has a statue in Miami. So has Orlando Bosch, another member of Operation 40. Very odd, very, very strange. There's even a holiday, as far as I know, in Miami, named for Orlando Bosch, a memorial type of day. I mean, these super assassins, real terrorists, if you've ever seen one, and then they have statues and all these odd. They saw themselves as freedom fighters, I think.
Yeah.
But when you look with objective eyes, they're absolute cold-hearted assassins and terrorists, I would say.
They put it out there in plain sight, don't they?
Anyway, then we go to the Texas School Book Depository, where... Mm-hmm. Lee Harvey Oswald is claimed to have been on the sixth floor and shooting from a window where he could absolutely not see the limo because there was a big, what's the name of the street? A big tree anyway.
Elm, a very, very
difficult shot through the branches and so on. Very, very difficult, not to say impossible. And also the timing of the shots, there's absolutely no way that anyone can fire three shots in the short, it was 5.6 seconds, the way they did. And especially with a Mannlicher Kakano, which is the rifle they claim he had, and the rifle that was found, there were actually three rifles found that day in that school book depository. One Mauser, one Mannlicher Kakano, and another one that I think was a British Enfield. But the one that they claim Lee Harvey Oswald used was this Mannlicher Kakano with a scope that was out of focus, and it was just the worst weapon. It was an Italian absolute crap weapon, you know.
What was the explanation for the other two rifles?
They have never officially acknowledged that they exist, but there are photos of them, you know, and the first report on TV. With TV reporters for the first almost 1 hour, it was a Mauser 7.2, I think. And also you have photos when them holding it up. There's photos up on the roof where they found another additional rifle. And there was one very brave man. His name was Craig. What was his name? I forgot now. Sheriff... Craig, Roger Craig, and he was there when they found the rifle. And he said, well, what is it? And there was one very, very weapons expert in the Dallas Police Department. He was there when they found it. And they picked it up, and all of them saw it said Mauser 7.5, a German-made Mauser. But then the official story was that it was a Mannlicher Carcano. And this Roger Craig, who also saw other things that day in Dealey Plaza and tried to speak out about it, he was later absolutely massacred. They tried to hit him so many times in car accidents. They tried to shoot him. They tried to all of... There's one very interesting documentary where it's called Two Men in Dallas, where they interview this guy. Very honest. I mean, if I have a hero, he's one of them. You know, absolutely beautiful person. And then he ended up in the end committing suicide, they say, blowing himself up with a shotgun. Well, many, I think about 300 witnesses or people that have been involved somehow in this assassination, the JFK assassination, have died around this. So the chances, I heard some statistics, the chances of dying violently or young, if you had anything to do with that assassination, was 1 trillion higher than for an ordinary person.
Mm. Hmm. So, and it's strange how journalists or media don't pick up on that.
I know, and this is why whoever you quoted before saying, I can't even see there's a question, I totally agree with him. I can't even see there's a question that it's Oswald, because it's absolutely not.
Yeah.
There are thousands. So it's so clear. I mean, you need to be absolute brain dead, I would say, when you look at the evidence and then you blame it on one person.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot even have a dialogue with somebody, you know, who claims that, if they look into the case, because then it's just absolute ridiculous.
Yeah, I had a similar example this afternoon, actually, trying to converse with someone about a topic and realizing there's no way.
But, you know, it's like I use what I call normal Farmer Brown logic. 1 + 1 = 2. If you are some laboratory expert or a professor or a 3D animation program super thing presented by NBC or whatever that says that 1 + 1 = 37, it's just not true. I mean, even if they can prove it, apparently it's not, you know. And then this is often a very good starting point, because if somebody's trying to push that down your throat, there's a reason why they try to cover this whole thing up. And then if you start backtracking that lie, it will lead to more lies, and it will slowly get you back to the real crime and the motive behind it. So it's through the lies that you can track these things.